Earlier this week, I visited the Reginald F. Lewis African American History and Culture Museum in downtown Baltimore to spend some time at their current exhibit. It's the Kinsey Collection, shared treasures of Bernard and Shirley Kinsey, where art and history intersect. It's a treasure trove of art and historical artifacts, including letters from Zora Neale Hurston and antique photographs chronicling over 400 years of African American history and culture, and telling the often untold story of African-American achievement and contribution to our society in ways I hadn't seen before this. I toured the exhibit with Bernard and Shirley Kinsey, the owners of the collection. Here's that conversation.
It's one of our biggest shows that we've done here in Baltimore, and we are really excited about exposing this area because Maryland, as you know, and Baltimore in particular, is a rich cultural inheritance for this country. I mean, Baltimore was founded not long after Jamestown, and free blacks, there were four big free black communities, and Baltimore is one of them: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. So even in the midst of all of the slavery, we had 800,000 free black people doing incredible things, being doctors and lawyers and teachers and ministers, inventing things. And those are the stories that the Kinsey Collection wants to bring out. We don't want to make this an ain't it awful story. Yes, slavery was awful, and it's despicable. But guess what? We want to talk about how people overcame rather than how they suffered. Because we don't think it's helpful for our young people to think anything other than they can achieve and aim higher than their parents.
So let's start with how you and your wife started this. I was told when I went through this the first time that, I forget which one when it went, but your wife was leans more towards the artistic side, more towards the historical side. How did all this begin?
Well, the historic part really started when our son Khalil was in the third grade, and he came home from a history report, and we couldn't answer some basic questions about our family or where he came from and who our family was.
Not uncommon in the black world.
Not uncommon at all. I mean, we could go back to my granddaddy or his great-granddaddy, but that wasn't far enough. So we knew immediately that we had to do something about that. And I began to explore a central question. And this is a question I will offer to your audience. How do we become black in America? That was the question I had always, it was an aching thing. I said, how do we get in this predicament in America, being black? Because it wasn't always that way. And it really got me into an extensive research and reading. So I read about 2 hours a night for the last 30, 35 years. I'm a historian. And while I'm a businessman in the daytime, what I really love is 17th, 18th, 19th century America. And I started off on World War II and, you know, everything about Germany and the Holocaust. I've been to Dachau, Auschwitz. I mean, I know all that story from Wilhelm on. But I didn't know the other side of this. How many black folks fought in World War II? Couple million, another million in World War I. And all these stories have just never been told. So we created a notion that we share. We'll share it at 3 o'clock today. It's called What You Didn't Learn in High School History. And what we're saying is that the myth of absence is what's operating in America every day. And the myth of absence simply says this, that we're there, we're just not part of the story. We're in the picture, but you just don't see us. And that story has been written from one viewpoint, and the Kinseys are trying to put the African-American narrative in the story, because the story of America is the story of Indians, Africans, and Europeans founding America and making it the great country we're in.
I always say to people that the narrative of history was always written by white America, and since the end of segregation legally, we're still struggling to find out what this next America is all about, and this is part of it.
Exactly, and well said. And a lot of people don't realize they go from slavery to civil rights. And what we say is there's a lot happened in that 100-and-some years. And that, you know, is something that we want people to explore. And we have some extraordinary individuals. Ignacio Sancho, who was born on a slave ship in the 1730s and goes on to become an opera singer in England, writes the first book in 1782. I mean, he performed before the king and queen, the duke and duchess. I mean, and the first African to vote in the election in England. He was born on a slave ship. Equiano, 1789. He was had six editions in his book in the first 4 years when they had no Amazon, no internet, no borders. So Phyllis Wheatley, who was as popular as Oprah Winfrey is today, she held court with George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. Young girl is 17, 18 years old, write the first book written by an African-American. So these are the stories and documents. And what makes the Kendrick Collection unique, we think, is because everything in there is original. Everything. What we're saying is you can go a long time and not see the real Dred Scott City. Now, you can hear a lot of people writing about it. Right. You can go a long time without seeing the Emancipation Proclamation or the Brown versus Board. All of these documents are real. And that's what we say to everybody. So, and this is not an African-American show. This is an American history show. And what we try to do is we go from 1595, which is we have one of the oldest documents known in the United States of an African-American couple being married in St. Augustine in Spanish Florida. So there are two ways to think about this. Here on the East Coast, we think about Jamestown and Mayflower. But if you look at the history of America, it really started in St. Augustine. And African-Americans, or Afro-Spanish, came here with Ponce de Leon in 1513. There's an African named Juan Garrido, G-A-R-I-D-O. Google it, okay? There's another brother named Esteban Durantes, who discovered the South in the Southwest before Lewis and Clark, 300 years before Lewis and Clark. And oh, by the way, Lewis and Clark had a brother on their expedition named York. So, I mean, we have been a part of everything that's happened in this country of any significance. And I always say that there's no way that America could be America if black folks weren't here.
There's no question about that.
I mean, the historical record that the Kendrick Collection represent shows it in so many ways, because all of our laws, folkways, mores, and behavior today is shaped by how we dealt with African Americans from the beginning, from the North to the South. So what we say is, there's nothing right or wrong about it, it's just understanding it. And if you go to Selma, Alabama, and wonder why the mentality is similar to what it's always been, it's because Selma was a place that the Confederate soldiers made all of their munitions. That was a munitions place. So people's livelihoods were invested in the war being won by the Confederates. And I can go town by town by town and tell you where, you know, if you go up upstate New York and Rochester, where the abolitionists, even today, it's always been more liberal than, quote, other places. So we know what shapes people's opinions and thoughts. And with that is how America got shaped. And what we're trying to do is to say that this narrative is part of the American story. This is our 14th city, believe it or not. And we've had over 4 million people see this around the country. You can go to Epcot right now and see the Kendrick Collection at the American Pavilion. We get a couple million people a year see it there. And Disney likes it so much, they want to increase it to a 5-year show. In the 1850s, Wells Fargo had black stagecoach drivers. In the 1880s, their president sent a letter to all their employees saying he wants to treat all black and white customers alike. I said, I mean, that's just extraordinary. So we know that Wells Fargo comes from a good place. And Ms. Lisa Friesen, their African-American segment manager, but she's also a vice president, she came up with the idea of having the Kendrick Collection to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. So why don't we hear from Lisa?
Absolutely. So what's your name again?
Lisa Friesen, Wells Fargo. At Wells Fargo, we wanted to find a way to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and knowing that it was going to be 2013 would be a historical year in terms of also being the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement. And in general, we want to make sure that we celebrate black history beyond February, because we feel very strongly that African-American history is American history, and it should be celebrated all year long. And so we came up with the idea of a national tour that we could honor these important contributions of African-Americans throughout the entire year. And so we're really proud to have being able to bring the Kinsey Collection to 3 notable African-American museums starting last year in February at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco, and then moved to Charlotte to the Harvey B. Gantt Museum, and now here in Baltimore at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum.
I think it's great to find a corporate sponsor that actually does this with this kind of commitment is rare. So that's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mark. I'm Shirley Kinsey. Yes.
So we start off here.
Oh, you want to know about this painting. This painting is done by an artist whose name is Artis Lane, and her mother actually named her that. That's her real
Artist
name.
Lane.
Yes.
A-R-T-I-S.
And she grew up to become an artist. And it was done in 2002. It's a gift to us by college friends for our 35th wedding anniversary. When we've known her since 1987, actually. She's painted some of everybody. Jamie Foxx commissioned her to do a painting of Miss Oprah Winfrey that he presented to her on her show. She's painted Michael Jordan. She's done Barbara Bush. She did Miss Jackie Onassis when she was Onassis. And just a lot of folks. She also is a sculptress. And she has a sculpture of Sojourner Truth that was unveiled by Mrs. Obama in 2009, and it's now housed in the Capitol Visitor Center. So your listeners can go and visit that. She also designed the Congressional Gold Medal that President Clinton presented to Mrs. Rosa Parks.
Wow.
Yes, so she's about 85 years old now, but still working. Her work is seen in Los Angeles quite a bit, and there's kind of always a retrospective of her stuff being done somewhere.
This portrait of the two of you, it does show the love between y'all.
And then the one of Khalil is done by the same artist, done in 1991, when Bernard retired from Xerox Corporation. That was a gift from the Xerox Black Employee Organization. So these two are very, very special to us, as you
they're
can understand.
Yeah. Gorgeous.
And because we know her and just, you know, she listens to your voice when she's painting. If there's a video, she wants to kind of watch your movements and stuff. Just does a beautiful job.
I was very taken with this. I wasn't aware of this artist until I walked into this museum.
Khalil, you may want to talk about that one a little bit.
First off, this painting is called The Cultivators and was done in 2000 by an artist. At the time, he was a student at the Savannah College of Art and Design. His name's Samuel Dunson. He's now a professor at Tennessee State University. But at the time, we were visiting Savannah, and my parents have a custom that when they are in a school, especially an art school, they will inquire about who their, you know, some of their standout artists are and some of their youngest and brightest. And Samuel Dunson's name kept coming up, and so they wanted to meet him. And they commissioned a painting. They like being able to support a young artist's vision and dream and their career. And you know, even when I was growing up, there were, I just remember shows, you know, art shows at my home, you know, where my parents would have a new artist that they had befriended or were supporting and would invite their friends to come and support as well and kind of help launch this artist's career. So they did the same, but just at Savannah College of Art and Design. So they commissioned him to paint a painting, but didn't ask him. They just told him to do what he does. And it took him a little while to get back with them, but when he did, this is the painting that he had, and it is characters. The characters in this painting represent my father, mother, and I. But you know, that was not what we asked him to do. We asked him just to go out and do what you do, you know. But after meeting us, he said that he saw us as cultivators of knowledge, you know, and harvesting knowledge. So as you see, it's like we're in with crops, but the crops are books, and they are planting and picking the books, and I'm reading The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, who I'm named after. So this is a very special piece.
That's who you're named after.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I fell in love with that artist as soon as we walked through the door the other day when we were in here for the first time.
Everybody loves that.
This has become one of the seminal pieces in the collection as far as marketing and and branding. This is the piece. If you go outside, the big sign and all of the signage has this piece.
The African-American story and the Kinsey family are connected. And we say we came from this place. This rock came from the Goree Island, which was the most infamous slave prison in Africa. And my DNA is Senegalese. So what we did was we made the connection that the Kinsey family came from Senegal, from this place, and our ancestors either walked on that rock or a rock like it. This sculpture is of the Maasai, which is African, obviously. So the connection with them here is Ed Dwight, who was the first astronaut trainee in 1960 under Kennedy. He decided he didn't want to be a astronaut. He wanted to be a sculptor. So he now is a sculptor. He goes to Senegal. The Senegalese government gives him two rocks. and allows him to take these out. He gives us one of the rocks. So now this rock and Ed are back together. Okay?
That's a great story. So that's a good story.
Now, I love our brothers and sisters. The whole thing about this hearts and souls is all of these brothers and sisters' lives mattered. And the basis for the Kinsey Collection is all about giving them a voice, a personality, and a name. So if you really have one thing to say about the Kinsey Collection, that's what it is. I mean, people know about Frederick Douglass, but they don't really know how he lived and what, and all of the things that he accomplished over and above what, you know, we talked about Lincoln and things like that. And what we do is, in our book, we nuance all of that. The Kinsey Collection is broken up in five different areas: transatlantic slave trade, slavery, Civil War, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, World War One, and civil rights. So what we've done is every aspect of African-American life, we have detailed it. So when we say that how slavery started, those are the actual documents that started slavery right here, those two right there.
And this, what do you mean they started slavery?
Well, slavery was like a franchise. I mean, you know, Germany, France, England, Denmark, Russia, everybody, not Russia, because Russia was the only country that didn't take people. And even today in Russia, they have a much different history with African Americans than European countries.
Pushkin on down.
Exactly. You got it. Okay. These are the documents that, and basically what they did, Mark, was they go out and they cut up 1,000 miles of the west coast of Africa and just cut it up. And everybody took so much in every country. This codified all of that in terms of who paid and how they paid and all that kind of stuff. This is the most important book here. This is Leo Africanus. This is 1632. The original book is 1550. Okay? This is a black man writing about black Africa before slavery decimated. And the book essentially says that we had figured it out already. When Europe was in the Middle Ages, we were astronomy, medicine, science, and all these, and we were doing extraordinary things. So what I tell people is that, yes, we came from Africa, but it was not a dark continent. It's a very aware and enlightened continent.
This is a print from like 60 years after the book was first written?
This is an actual book from 1632.
Gotcha.
Now, the Muslims used to carry small books because they used to fold them inside their it's like a sash. It's like the Japanese do with their kimonos.
Right.
They have the big sash, and that's where they put the, you know, they store things in there. And so they had to have small books to be able to do that. So that's why that book is that
amazing way. That you have that book.
It is amazing. It is amazing. Look at this one here. The account of the African slave trade from 1795 to 1806. It lists every ship that left England, went to Africa, and came to the Americas. It's just extraordinary. And you can go by ship, captain, how many of us were taken, and where, how many of us got there.
Did you sit down with this book, and have you gone through it?
Oh, yeah. I've gone through every one of them. So when we say early genius, you got to give Frederick, his props. Because that's what he was. He was early genius. This is by Tina Allen, in her own right, one of our top sculptures. And Frederick Douglass, had he not escaped slavery, I always ask, how would we be different now? Had he been caught on the train trying to leave Maryland, going north? It was just a fluke that he got through.
It would have reshaped history.
It would have reshaped history because we would not have had 180,000 black people fighting for the Union Army, and we would have lost the war.
When I came by these paintings we're about to look at here, first, one thing that struck me, why this is so important, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is this Robert Duncanson and the other painters here. These are landscape paintings, paintings that are by African-Americans, but of just art. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not Africana.
It's not black. Well, let's say it this way. There's no such thing as black art or white art.
Right.
It's just art.
It's just art.
Now, through the lens of America, we put color on everything, and because of that, people have to identify it. I would love for us to get to a place where we don't talk about black folks and white folks. It's just folks. But as long as America operates on color, we have to be clear about it, because you get hurt out here if you think this world got open arms for black folks, because we know doggone well it doesn't. These paintings represent, there were three genres that were done in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. It was landscapes, still lifes, and portraitures. So this is a landscape, still life, and portrait. But back in those days, that's what people bought, so that's what people painted. So 1865, Robert Duncan said, you can go to Cincinnati today and go to the Taft House, and the Duncanson murals are there right now. They are just gorgeous. It's one of the top attractions in Cincinnati. Black man.
Part of the Hudson School.
Exactly.
Right.
1840s. This brother moved from Philadelphia all the way to San Francisco. He used to draw maps. Matter of fact, Wells Fargo has one of his maps he drew. He really became famous for being so detailed. He's a lithographer. So a lithographer, instead of painting foreground and background, he paints everything as you see it. So this is Grafton Tyler Brown. He wanted to be an artist. So he said, I don't want to do maps. I want to paint. So he goes to Mount Tacoma, which is now Mount Rainier, and then Canada, and he paints landscapes, 1885. Charles Ethan Porter, 1890, Connecticut, same thing. These are peonies. But it's the same thing. If you're a painter, it's tough to make a living. You got to paint what people will buy. Edward Bannister. This brother won the highest award for art in 1876, period. And because he was black, they didn't want to give it to him. They forced him to repaint it before they gave it to him, and he obviously did, okay? But Edward Bannister is one of our great painters that ever lived. Most people don't know.
Period.
Right. He was married to Christina Carteau. Let me tell you about Christina. Christina owned beauty salons in Boston. Boston had one of the largest free black populations. Really, black folks doing well. So Christina hired Edward in 1850. And I surmise that he worked for her for a few years. They got married. And she was making enough money to tell him to go paint. Ain't that a good one?
I like that.
Okay.
Like that.
And here's Owasso Tanner. Tanner was one of the first black artists to go and make it big in Paris, because almost everybody left here. Because if you learned French or German or Italian, you were okay, because America is the only country that operates purely on color. In these other countries, if you speak the language, you're just foreign. In other words, we go to Shanghai all the time. We never have any problems in Shanghai or Beijing or Hong Kong, because you're foreign either way. People don't, you know. They know where you, but it's no, you don't feel like people are against you or discriminating against you. And it's one of the big things that America still has to deal with. And that's why you have to have a Martin Luther King Day to remind people of what is going on in this country that's not working.
You're listening to a conversation with Bernard and Shirley Kinsey, owners of the amazing Kinsey Collection, now at the Reginald F. Lewis African American History and Culture Museum in downtown Baltimore. There's a lot more of a conversation coming up, so stay with us. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner. Welcome back, everybody. I visited Baltimore's Reginald F. Lewis African American History and Culture Museum earlier this week to meet Bernard and Shirley Kinsey, who are owners of the Kinsey Collection. It's an amazing collection that they've been collecting for over 40 years of historical artifacts and artwork that tells the story of African-American achievement and its contribution to the United States in ways only these artifacts and the stories around them can tell. Here's more of that conversation.
The great speech of 1852 in Rochester, right here. You'll go the rest of your life and never see that one. Where 4th of July, he tells the white women in Rochester, shame on you for bringing me down here to talk about this, and you really aren't stepping up. This is Henry Flipper, 1877, the first graduate of West Point, and they have a concept called silent, and for 4 years, no one spoke to him. No one studied with him, no one played with him. He graduated alone for 4 years. Charles Young graduated a few years later, the third graduate, the same thing. Here you have guys that in this case that were so good that they could go through all of that and still graduate from college. And that's why we tell our young people, hey, you're telling me you can't graduate from high school? Come on. And that's why it's important that they come here, because they begin to see that their issues aren't the issues they think they are. We really had some issues back in the day, okay? Benjamin Banneker, 1796. We know about Benjamin. First book written by an African-American, Phyllis Wheatley. Came here, spoke nothing but Guinea. Learned how to read, write. 2 years she's speaking Greek and Latin. 4 years she's playing the piano, the violin. And 7 years she writes a book. I mean, it's amazing. As popular as Oprah Winfrey in her day. Equiana, 6 editions in the first 4 years of this book. And anybody that reads Equiana is reading the only person that's written a book about being on a slave ship is Equiana. So people talk about being on a slave ship, but they weren't on it. They read about it and then wrote about it. This brother was on it. 1790, fugitive slave law. This is one of the most pernicious laws done in America. Our first president, George Washington, he signed that. And George Washington, frankly, with the signature on this, unleashed this guilty versus being innocent in America. And that's what's operating in the justice system today, right here in Baltimore and every major city. That's why you can have stop and frisk in New York, and people really think that's okay.
If you read this, any person may kill and destroy said slave.
Any person may kill and destroy. So now it's not just kill and destroy, but basically that's what happens. They shoot a black man every day, and it ain't no big deal. When is the last time a police officer has really been convicted for manslaughter? You follow me? Now, I know they got a tough job, and I know there are a whole lot of tough brothers and sisters out here, but the fact of the matter is, you can't tell me that there are all these murders that nobody has ever found guilty. And that's why the black community recoils against it, because they know something inherently is wrong with a system that continues to come back to the same innocent, when you know doggone well you cannot shoot a Florida A&M graduate, one of my alumni. He gets shot, you know, in outside of Charlotte trying to seek help. A black woman gets shot in the face trying to seek help.
Right.
Now, I know if there were a white man or a white woman, that would never happen. First of all, they would have rendered aid, because they would have been thinking that this person needed help. When they see us, they think we're out to try to get somebody. And that's the problem with this thing. So the Kinsey Collection is saying all of this came from someplace. Here's the 3/5 compromise. This gave the South the opportunity to essentially have all of its laws enacted in Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidency for 100 years. That's what this document does. More than any other document in terms of codifying the slave codes and the treatment of African American, this document does it. 1832 is one of the first documents we got, of bill of sale of a young brother out of Alabama for $550.
So, which is like $14,000 in today's money.
$14,000, you got the math. I love this piece. This is Beza Butler. She's a sister out of New Jersey. This represents 4 million black people working on 75,000 plantations in the South that produced $3 billion in cotton, more assets than everything else in America combined. Think about it. More than railroads, banks, real estate, shipping. Our labor produced and brought America from a backward country and catapulted us ahead of England and France in one generation. So you're saying that black folks don't have some say and some dibs in this? That's what we say. Don't act like this. You some kind of way work your way into this, you know, existence. And for America not to acknowledge the very presence of our labor of not being paid is what this issue is all about. Now, whether we do that in reparations or whatever, but the fact of the matter is this country could not be its country if it didn't have free labor for literally 300-400 years. Okay? Now, let's look at it. So all of this really started the Civil War. Actually, the Dred Scott decision, which is in the other case, Dred Scott basically said that anybody that's black in this country, free or not, has no rights. So everybody knew then that we had to have a war, because the South was not willing to give up anything as it relates to African Americans. Lincoln, our good President Lincoln, went to the South and offered them a deal that if you will, you can keep your enslaved people, and we don't say slave, we say enslaved. You can keep your enslaved people until 1900 if you will stay in the Union. You know what the South told him? Pound sand. So he had no other choice than to start the war. 180,000 black folks fought in the Civil War. Without this, the Union Army would have lost the war. Let me tell you what would have happened in America. America would be a very different country if the South ran this country. And people say, well, I'd be okay. But I said even white males wouldn't be okay, because the freedoms that we enjoy today all came out of the freedoms that African Americans pushed and fought for from the beginning. I mean, women would have a hell of a time in this country. You know, a woman back in the 18th, 19th century had no rights, didn't vote until 1922. You follow me? Almost 50 years after African Americans could vote. So we know that, you know, would you think you would have a Disability Act in America if the South owned the South? Heck no. I mean, this was all about greed. This is Natchez, Mississippi, 1860, was the richest city in the world. Natchez.
So let me ask you this as we walk through, because I know you got to leave. As we're going over here, tell us how did you acquire all this stuff?
Just look, first of all, you have to know the whole story. When you know the whole story, you know what the piece parts are. So when I start, look, if you get the vote in 1867, you get these congressmen in the 41st and 42nd Congress. So the next thing is, how do I find them? So I went out looking for each of them. This is Matthew Brady, the famous photographer. He photographed this brother, this senator.
And while we're standing here, this is the day that he was sworn into the Senate, on this day in 1870.
See, I didn't notice that. Okay, so that's good, Mark. So that's real good. Okay, so here you got a brother from Mississippi, the first senator, and the second senator in the United States that was African American came from Mississippi also. Okay, and also was the treasurer of the United States to sign money. This is in the 1870s. Okay. Joseph Josiah Walls from Florida. And what if you look at these, we have the signatures of each of these. So the only way you can get closer to this brother, you got to get in the grave with him. Okay? Emancipation Proclamation, September 24th, 1862. What Lincoln did, he signaled to the Union Army that we're going to change. We're going to have black folks in this war. And so that's what this did. Before he gave this to the public, he signaled to the Union Army to get ready, because we're going to have 180,000 black folks doing it. This is one of the most important decisions in American history, the Dred Scott decision. If you ever go to St. Louis and go to that courthouse, he and his wife Harriet left St. Louis and went to Minnesota, Chicago, free states, and thought that they were free. When they came back, they said, no, Dred Scott, you are not free. You are back as being an enslaved person. So he said, you got to be kidding. So he sued. He sued all the way through the courts, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they came back. They said, not only are you not free, there's nobody that's African-American in this country that's free, including the 800,000 free blacks that had always been free. So that's, you know, you got to have a war. And Dred Scott was the driving force in that piece. So, but here's America operating at its fullest. Justice Taney was the justice of the Supreme Court. So here's what we do with the kids.
A Maryland guy.
No, Virginia. We go deep and wide. He was the second largest slaveholder in America, and he votes on Dred Scott. How could you do that? You should recuse yourself, right? But see, this is what kind of foolishness we got. We got a justice saying, heck no, you can't be free. You're going to make me poor. Now, what kind of foolishness is that? So, but if you look at this without that piece of information, you kind of think that maybe the Supreme Court is fair. Ain't nothing fair about that. Because they got self-interest. And those interests are not the interests of the American public, okay? Of a few slaveholders, okay? Because most of white America did not own slaves during the 18th, 19th century. There were just large slaveholders. I mean, huge slaveholders. You know, Tiffany? You know where Tiffany got that money? You know, the little blue box? from Charles Tiffany, from Montgomery Cotton. And I can take you through all these companies. Okay, Chase Bank, all of them. A lot of stuff here. Oh, I love this book here. Slavery by Another Name won the Pulitzer in 2009. Doug Blackman, now a friend. I'm reading this in 2008, going to see my mama in West Palm Beach. On page 8, there's a reference to an enslaved person. Well, she really kind of, well, African-American woman, July 31st, 1903, named Kara Kinsey. I knew instantly that was my relative, and it was. It was my second cousin. So what she's writing President Roosevelt for is complaining that her brother had been kidnapped, literally by the sheriff, and really sold into slavery. This book exposes over 400,000 African-American men, some women, and a few whites that were just put back into slavery. So the book says the re-enslavement of black Americans from the Civil War to World War II, that is not a misprint. Okay, and it went on to 1942, called The Penitentiary System or Convict Labor. So what you got is someone, vagrancy laws. That's why black people get picked up all the time now. I mean, if you're sitting on the corner just kicking it with your boys, the cops come up and say, well, what are you doing here? Man, I'm just kicking it. They say, you got to go home. Well, why do I have to go home? This is a free country. Next thing, you're in jail. And that started really with 1790 with George Washington. But this is a kind of law called slave codes. When you go home, get your Google out and put in slave codes and put in Maryland, put in Virginia, put in South Carolina. It will flat scare you. What white America did was criminalize black life, period. In other words, I could not walk on a sidewalk in the 50s if a white person was on it, okay? Couldn't play checkers with a white person. Couldn't be at a railroad track because you think you're going to try to run away. I mean, all these kinds of laws that were strictly enforced. You couldn't read, you couldn't write, all this kind of stuff. And we all grew up with this, okay? Alabama. This is a great one, the civil rights period. You got Thurgood Marshall, our good Thurgood Marshall. Without the civil rights period, we probably would still be in some form of enslavement. I say black folks didn't get out of enslavement in the South really until about 1970. Because in the 65, you still weren't, you didn't have no rights. You thought you did, but if you crossed the line too much, you could get beaten up or whatever.
So how did you run across the drinking fountain white-colored? Where did you run across that?
I don't know. Look, I'm on it. People know I'm on it. I get the first dibs on anything of real importance. And, you know, we worked at it. People know that we're serious. I want the best representation of that historical record that we can get. And that's what we've been trying to do. This is the Brown versus Board of Education. You'll never see that signed by the justice. And if you didn't have this, you wouldn't have here. If you don't have the Brown versus Board, you don't have Martin Luther King. You don't have the March on Washington. You don't have Malcolm X. And this is the sign that the sanitation workers carried the day after King was killed in 1968. And this is all of the artistic beauty of our people that really started. You notice all the landscapes over here?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, black folks are painting their existence. So now we're painting who we are and what we are instead of just landscapes and things like that. And it all started with the Harmon Foundation right here. And the intellectual capital for all of black America came out of Howard University and Dunbar High School, right across from here. And that's where all of that intellectual capital fueled what we now know. Elaine Locke, right here, the first Rhodes Scholar, 1907, taught at Howard for 40 years in economics. He gave black folks permission to paint. So let me say, now you have this information. What do you think? Have you a different opinion about this subject than what you've had before?
Do I have a different opinion? Mm-hmm. No.
Okay.
Because I'm a student of history.
Okay. Yeah,
so,
all right.
But what's new to me is what you've collected and how you've put it together and the sequence you put it together and seeing the documents that actually reflect what happened. And we can't touch it. We can feel it by being this close to it.
That's right.
Right? That's what you've given
us.
That's
the idea, to give our ancestors a voice, a personality, and a name. That's what this is about. They didn't just live and die. They mattered. They meant something. And they contributed, like we all contribute. And to the large extent, American history still is being written because people aren't, I mean, we don't get the opportunity. There's a saying that the hunter, if the hunter is writing the book, he writes it from a hunter's view. If you're being hunted, you write it from a different point of view. And that's what we want to say with this African-American history, because we believe this really is American history, pure, pure, pure.
Now, I'm going to dump what I'm going to ask you now in the middle of this conversation somewhere else, because I have to ask you this question about the Zora Neale Hurston letter. That letter. I love that letter.
Yeah. Well, this is Shirley should answer this, because her uncle, Mr. Webster, was a personal friend of Zora and left those to Shirley.
Yes. I grew up in St. Augustine, Florida, and Zora Neale Hurston actually used to spend time in St. Augustine. She actually taught school at the taught English, I guess, during the summer at the college there in my hometown. And my uncle met her really when they were at Columbia in New York, so he'd known her for a while, and she would come and stay there. There's markers in St. Augustine now where she lived when she was in town there. But that particular letter you're speaking of, she wrote to Mr. Price, and she copied in all her friends. That was her soon-to-be ex-husband. Now, it's dripping with venom, as if you read it, you saw, and everybody should really read that letter. And then after that, they kind of got back together for a little bit. She ultimately divorced him, thank goodness. But that letter, yeah, really just does just say, and she's, her wit was just so vibrant. I mean, and that just, that's just who she was.
When I read that, it made me think, never cross pens with a writer.
Yes, 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 yes. Never know what they're going to write about you and what they're going to say. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I didn't know, of course, when I was growing up, that he knew her. I always tell young people now, I say, interview your ancestors. They're going to be your ancestors. Interview your parents, your grandparents. Start recording all this stuff with the technology you have now, because I wish I had asked. He was my principal when I was in elementary school, so I didn't, you know, you kind of standoffish anyway then. But I didn't know that he knew her. I didn't know anything about her too much when I was growing up either, though. But, you know, as I grew up, she became my favorite writer, and then he dies, and they have these letters. I have three books, too, at home that she signed to him. So it's really, yeah, it's interesting.
It's a great legacy.
You never know what's in your heritage there, you know? So, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you, both of you, for putting this collection together and sharing it with the world like this.
Thanks.
It's amazing.
One thing I'd like to say is that, you know, Bernard always talks about, we both say that because it's where art and history intersect, that's our passion, both of us, but he's more the historian. So I say I've become friends with a lot of the artists that we collect who are still alive. He's become good friends with a lot of the dead artists and dead people. Knows them very intimately, so that's him. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can still make the phone calls you can.
Yes, exactly, exactly, exactly. So that's always.
You did a lot of this collecting here.
Yeah, a lot of the art, really, we're on together, but there's several artists in here that are very special to me and personal friends. For instance, the ones we started out with up front, you know, they've become very good friends. I mean, we celebrate holidays together. Ed Dwight, Artist Lane, Phoebe Beasley is on the wall over there. And they're all good friends, you know. So I get to celebrate with them and share them with him, and then he gets to celebrate with
This is great.
Yeah, for instance, that piece in the back there always reminds me of home. It's Matthew Thomas, and while the method that he uses is very interesting, but it reminds me of dried up dirt clay in St. Augustine, Florida, when I was growing up. Mm. When it would dry in the sun, it would crack like that. And I wasn't black. It was red and kind of orangey colored. But that's what that reminds me of. And so a lot of the pieces are things that remind us of home. There's a little girl, one in the back there.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I always say that's me jumping rope. My house, if it was torn down, would be about like that. I said, and that's me jumping rope, looking out. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm going somewhere. I see something out there, and I'm going somewhere. And so, you know, they all personal kind of connections and stuff and all.
So you're both from Florida, right?
Or yes. Mm-hmm. He's from West Palm Beach, Florida, and I grew up in St. Augustine. That's the other thing that's always funny. I always say I grew up with the oak trees and the pines and the moss in the trees, and he grew up with the palm trees and the avocado trees and the orange trees in South Florida.
Now you were involved, you were involved in the civil rights movement, weren't
yes.
you? And you're in college.
Yeah. Well, Dr. King had actually come to my hometown the summer of 63. And that was the year I graduated from high school. Well, my grandmother was quite frightened because of what was going on in the country at that time, and she didn't want me to be there because we were all trying to get involved. And so she sent me to North Carolina where my sister was in college, which wasn't the best thing either. But being in North Carolina, really, Chapel Hill had just happened a little time before that. So I really kind of got involved in wanting to know how I could be involved. So as soon as I got to school, it was like about 2 weeks after the March on Washington, And the March on Washington was my sister's birthday, so we couldn't go to it. But when I got to school, there was SNCC and CORE on campus, and they were beginning to have marches, or had been having them for years, actually, since 1959. But I immediately got involved. And the first protest I took part in, I was part of a group that got arrested at 17, scared to death, on scholarship and, you know, worried about losing my scholarship and all that kind of stuff. And was in jail for 3 days. We were charged with trying to fill the jails, thinking that they didn't have any more room for us, but that wasn't the case. No. And they actually took us out to the county work camps, really, where the men were housed who were working on the chain gangs. And I mean, we were scared to death because here you are, you know, 5 feet from another barrack, so to speak, and there's no window, I mean, nothing on the windows to close. You know, it's getting cool now. There's, you know, one little sheet on the bed. It was horrible. And I mean, quite frightening. Enough that it scared me that I didn't really march anymore, to be honest with you. I had to throw away my clothes because he had them on for 3 days, you know, and we were told that because we were freshmen, it was our first time being arrested, you know, that we could stay in school. But had the second arrest, now you're going to be incarcerated, you're going to be fined, you're going to be all that stuff, and you don't know what's going to happen to you. But you know, I like to think that we kind of have circled back around. While we're not protesting, carrying signs and stuff, we're able to share this with the world, you know. When we went to California in 1967, you know, we just got married, and for us, we really were leaving the South. You know, it was like, we don't even want to be here anymore. You know, tired of not being able to try on clothes in the store. You know, my grandmother made all my clothes, you know. Tired of not being able to do what we wanted to do, and California beckoned. And things were much better. I mean, there's still work to be done there, too, also. But we also knew that we really couldn't leave home behind because that was where home was, and that's family, and that's who made us, you know. So our friends in California are always saying, you know, y'all go back there all the time. You have a house down there. We say, as long as we have family there, we do, you know. And I don't ever want to be away from what made me. I don't ever want to be away from that. And that's the one thing with this exhibit I always want young kids to think about, too, is that, you know, they see this, and one little girl even said to us, well, how much money did this cost? And I said, you know, it's not about that at all. And we didn't go out buying stuff. You know, it was years of doing this.
Lifetimes worth of work.
Yeah. And it grows on you. It kind of just becomes mm-hmm. who you are.
That was Bernard and Shirley Kinsey, owners of the amazing Kinsey Collection, shared treasures of Bernard and Shirley Kinsey, where art and history intersect. It's now at the Reginald F. Lewis African American History and Culture Museum in downtown Baltimore. You don't want to miss this exhibition. I mean, it's really amazing. It'll just grab you. Some of the artifacts in this collection are unbelievable and are here in our city until March the 2nd. For more information about the Reginald F. Lewis Museum and this exhibition, visit rflewismuseum.org. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Stay tuned. We have a great conversation about the women's role in theater right after this break. Don't want to miss this either. Stay here.